Well, good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. The United Lodge of Theosophists is a fraternity, or a family, or a group of volunteers who work together to study and practice and promulgate the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy. And when we hear the word theosophy in the United Lodge of Theosophists, we're referring to the teachings as recorded by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. We are loyal to the founders of the theosophical movement, and our devotion individually is really exactly that. It's an individual choice on how we're going to study and apply the teachings and contribute to the lodge and to the world around us. But also as a lodge, this lodge is entirely independent. There's no one or no thing dictating to us outside of the people within the lodge telling us what we're supposed to do. Simply, we follow what's called the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And this declaration is followed by all the United Lodges of Theosophists throughout the world. So we do, in principle, together, all the same thing, which is to promulgate the philosophy, to exemplify the philosophy to others, which will, in time, through study and effort, help us to come to a fuller realization of ourselves and who we are, and therefore a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. The Lodge regards anyone and everyone as a theosophist, whether or not they've ever heard the word theosophy before, if they live their lives in service to humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And anyone is welcome to associate themselves with the Lodge if you find yourselves in accord with the principles of the Lodge and are willing to fit yourself to be the better able to help and teach others and be of service. So we have our meetings twice a week on a Sunday from 11 to 12. Today our talk is, or rather just for the month of October, the umbrella theme for the month of October is Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement. And our talk for today is What is Theosophy? It's from 11 to 12, and the doors open at 10:30 every Sunday. On Wednesday evenings also, the doors open at 5:30, and there is a reference library available from 5:30 to 7:30 with straight-line theosophical teachings, books, pamphlets, magazines, etc., as well as other references, philosophical and the arts and sciences. It's there for anyone who chooses to pursue a particular line of study regarding his theosophical endeavors. That's Wednesdays from 5:30 to 7:30. Then at 7:45 to 9 o'clock on Wednesdays, we have a class, a little less formal than on Sundays, a class on theosophy. We're following a book called The Ocean of Theosophy, which is a synthesis of the secret doctrine. It's, on the one hand, simple to read and very understandable, but at the same time, very deep, very profound, can be read many, many times, and we continue to learn each time we go through it for the year. So those are our activities, and we will today have a panel discussion on what is theosophy. Each speaker will have about 7 to 10 minutes to chat, to give a talk, and then after the two of us are finished, the rest of the hour, of course, is dedicated to contributions, discussion, questions, etc.
What is theosophy? Well, that question, to be answered so that we understand it, is that we are told that when we come in this building, that we should suspend all that belief system which we presently hold, those ideas which we have assimilated during our lifetime, and take a fresh look at these ideas without prejudice or any kind of what we would call difficulty with what is being said. Now, we're going to tell you what theosophy is. And by doing that, that only means that you know what it is. But to understand it, one must study for himself. And one must investigate for oneself. So, theosophy, putting it simply, is the accumulated wisdom of the ages. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, that through vast periods of evolution, these ideas have ever been present. And that sages, perfected beings, all through the history of mankind, have pronounced these ancient teaching, this wisdom religion, this divine ethics. For Plato, Pythagoras, the Neoplatonist, Alexander, Ammonium Saccas, Plotinus, Porphyry, Umbilicus, all of these taught this same science. And we have other in this recent age that have also propounded these ideas. We would find in Shakespeare many references to theosophy, only in the sense that things are given out in parables and to correspondence and through analogy. So we walk in these rooms and something has brought us here. Well, first of all, for many of us, it's the understanding of what God is. Because in our rational mind, it doesn't compute. You know, an exalted being who judges over us and is wrathful is confusing. And we're not satisfied, as all of you probably are not satisfied. We come to theosophy, and theosophy states that there is only one principle, only one, that is eternalist, eternal, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent. It's a principle. And that this principle never was, never will be, and always is. Or I said something like that. I think it was backwards, but it is an eternal principle. It has no beginning, it has no end. And we have to try to grasp with our minds. And one of the analogies that we are presented with is space. If we consider space, there is nothing that is not in space. And when something is removed from space, space still exists. So that consideration alone opens up one's mind to expand our consciousness. Because this God principle pervades the entire universe. Now man is at the apex of evolution. And that everything in the universe is alive, so that nothing is outside that one principle. Man being self-conscious puts him at the top. For through his decisions, for or against something, things either progress or are halted and held back. We live our lives hoping to be free. And the only freedom that we can really obtain is that of our mind. If our minds are free, we are free. So theosophy tells us there are the only obstacles in our lives are the ones that we have placed there. And each time that we incarnate, we take up the journey. But this one principle is what this world is that we are living in now. It's a world of harmony. It's a world of cause and effect. So each life we live are the effects of prior lives. So in this life, we can create a new future. For it is said, man is the great creator, which goes back to that first principle. For everyone has that spark of deity within them. Everyone. That as we have evolved, we have become immersed in matter, and we have forgotten our deific nature. But we are gods in the making. Plato said this, and all the great philosophers said this. That what we do now determines what we will be in future lives, or what will be the next moment. We are creators. And that this idea, or these ideas called theosophy, are ever protected in the world. For truth itself has great power. And there are those beings that have passed through this evolutionary process long before we have arrived here in this lifetime. But they have accumulated this wisdom. They have checked, tested, and verified it against all other experiences of all other adepts, perfected beings. So the perfectibility of man is a reality, just as brotherhood is not an ideal, but it is a fact in nature. So this idea of God, it is not limited. It is limitless. The mind has to be set free. And to set it free, we cannot hold ideas that create the world we live in. That this is not one life. There is not vicarious atonement. That there is but one God. There is, but in theosophy we don't use that term because it is too confusing to many who have been brought up in this world of Christianity and Judaism and all the other religions. It is not that. It is more than that. So we become the judge and jury of our own life. The things that we do, we experience in return. So theosophy shows us that we are responsible for everything that we see and do. The task of addressing that responsibility is one of understanding and discrimination. But it doesn't come quickly. It takes great effort. If we want those diamonds or that pieces of gold, we have to dig for them. We have to sacrifice. And we have to really want it. But it's not a matter of our ego wanting it, but that part of us that is selfless, and it exists in everyone. And that we know who we are. We know that there is something unchangeable about everyone. And our role is to uncover that unchanging aspect of ourself. Well, that's just a little bit. I'm sure we'll hear more from the next speaker.
Well, some of the ideas that we've heard so far, it relates to freeing the mind, spirit. We talked about God, deity. A lot of this sounds religious in nature, and there's a phrase we recall that that we are mind beings beyond whatever we see within ourselves. We are mind beings, and Theosophy tells us that mind is the power to think, and each human being has that power. We each tend to think somewhat differently, or in other words, we use that power differently, and based on that, we it seems to us that we're all different. Now, Theosophy has a lot to say about that, to overcome some of the differences and to see the true nature of things. Last Wednesday, we had a class in the Ocean of Theosophy. It happened to be the first class, page one, chapter one. And in that part, we find out that Theosophy is known as the science of sciences. Theosophy is called the wisdom religion. What is Theosophy? It's called a religious science, it's called a scientific religion, and certainly anyone who attends theosophical meetings knows that there are these high-level philosophical / spiritual topics that are discussed. Yet, even though these spiritual truths are promulgated, and even though for the past 150 years, almost 150 years, students of Theosophy have been propagating them and defending the teachings of the original founders of the Theosophical movement regarding these teachings, many of which are spiritual, yet the co-founders are insistent that, well, we know that Theosophy is not a religion. So if it's not a religion, we could say that it's a body of knowledge for sure. And we're told, you know, the universal nature of it, it leaves out nothing. So if there were a universal body of knowledge or a universal system of thought, what would it look like? It would have to, or what it wouldn't look like is it couldn't just set parameters and say, you have to do this, or you have to be this, or you have to look like this. It would have to be human, it would have to be universal in nature, and therefore it would have to encompass all of humanity, not just some of humanity. And if it's universal in nature, given that one of the three fundamental propositions of the philosophy, without understanding that, we'll never really fully understand the philosophy, one of the three fundamental propositions is the proposition of evolution, that soul and spirit is ever evolving through all forms of matter, through all forms. So if we're going to have a system of thought that truly is universal, then it has to include all of humanity. And if everything is continuously evolving, then it has to include all that has not yet evolved to be fully human. And it has to include all those beings that have been human, but now are beyond humanity. So then, if it's, okay, so, all right, so therefore it's got to include everything and bind everything, therefore, into one grand whole. And so then we would say that Theosophy is not a religion, but if it is truly universal, then Theosophy is religion itself, because that's what the word religion means, is to bind together. And if it's a universal religion, then all is bound as one grand whole. So how do we reconcile the contradiction then, that we spread these religious ideas and yet say that it's not a religion? It's because really Theosophy is religion per se, not limited to a particular group. Now, there's the saying that theosophist is who theosophy does. A theosophist is who theosophist does. Now, a person who practices the philosophy of theosophy and lives it in his daily life, there are those who live it. It has a tendency, therefore, to refine the soul of the individual, to transmute, because he's living, as was said earlier, there's a selfless component. That part of the prerequisites for living the theosophical life is to look at yourself, see where we are, and move from whatever within us may be selfish, slowly to move toward unselfish, and ultimately to be selfless. And so it has this refining process just by thinking the thoughts and putting them into action, and certainly by sharing these thoughts with others. This is similar to, if anyone's read, you know, about the alchemists of the Middle Ages, where the alchemists always, you know, the analogy is that they wanted to trans the base metal of their nature into gold. That's transforming our lower nature and transmuting it into the higher nature, the gold of truth within ourselves. Now, if that's the goal, then certainly we can't limit access to these teachings. There's no requirement of a particular religion, and there's not a requirement to have no religion. There's no, you know, without respect to sex, ethnicity, religion, etc., etc., everyone is welcome to study theosophy because of its universal nature in the lodge. How many of those people who have left religion and perhaps now consider themselves atheists because of their disappointment or disenchantment on a personal level with their religion, how many of them would still be out there without even thinking those thoughts unless maybe they came to theosophy just to give it a chance and see what these kind of truths, these ideas will open within them? These truths no doubt give a sense of hope and aspiration and inspiration to the people who make the effort to learn and apply them. So theosophy as a philosophy has an effect on the individual and on the people around him. Theosophy as science, through the ages there has been symbolism. If the student takes the time and the effort to look across time and civilizations, we find that there is a universal symbolism that demonstrates the unity and the common source of all the world's faiths and sciences. Some of the examples can be found in architecture, examples can be found in the zodiac, etc. There is a commonality among civilizations that there is a common source of a universal system of thought. And it is said that actually a study of theosophy reveals that theosophy is scientific, grounded in mathematical laws, and it will demonstrate philosophical ideas that are today considered but fairy tales, that were known at one time, that the materialistic scientists and the materialistic religionists of the day would consider fairy tales. But a student of the philosophy can look at some of these ancient ideas and see the truths within them. So practical theosophy, we would say, is the art of living. And the art of living, if we live our lives thoughtfully, mindfully, reflectively, this gives us an appreciation for the science of life, both moral and physical. So theosophy is a system of universal thought, if we live it, which actually gives us the insight to set up certain causes within ourselves and will fit us in certain ways, even for future lives to come. The decisions, the actions, and the thoughts that we hold today on inner levels in deeper ways set a path that don't just affect our lives in the present, but really will carry forth into future lives. Theosophy teaches about the unity of everything in nature. Unity implies the unit of one plane to be able to contact a unit on or from another plane. This is a theosophical teaching. It's known as co-adonition in nature. And this unity justifies that the recognition that the existence of this body of knowledge, which is the synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy, shows the connection of man and all things in the universe with each other. And therefore, such knowledge has to be religion per se, because it is all bound together. So we refer to it as the wisdom religion. Then finally, of course, it is from this wisdom religion that all the particular religions of the world spring from. It is the mother source, and that mother source of all those religions we call Theosophia. So those are some ideas here, and your contributions, questions, and discussions are welcome. Yes.
You spoke of fairy tales that were at one time scientific evidence, I believe. Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of that?
Well, Theosophy tells us that there is so much truth in the mythology of the civilization that if we look at it only as fairy tales, we're missing the history of the evolution of man. And so for instance, one example we'll give is, you know, we've heard of different things that have been done by great sages of the past that appear to be magical things. Well, a student of Theosophy, we're certainly not saying that come to Theosophy so you can learn how to be magic, but a student who studies the philosophy, applies it to himself, can come to an appreciation that, you know what, the reality of life is we are all in evolution, and there are certain aspects of the human being that can do some fantastic things that maybe we personally can't do. But if we're open to learning it, we can start to prove it to ourselves philosophically, which can be more true than in the physical world, that man is capable of doing far more than we give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, because we are more than what we just see in the mirror.
We think one of the obvious examples of that are fairy tales themselves. Giants, cyclopses. HPB tells us that there, in our literature of fairy tales, there is a grain of truth within all of that. So that it refers to prior periods of evolution, but it has meaning. And there are many fairy tales that have meaning that are beyond simply fantasy. But one needs to look and examine anything that they read and try to find an analogy that will correspond to the idea that is being presented in the fairy tale. There's another one, the Kings of Edom, I think it's in the Bible or so forth. But there's many examples of what we would consider to be fairy tales, but it really is an analogy, sure. Analogy on something.
And of course, you know, we don't claim to be experts on, we're all students here, and we're trying to give examples here. One example, you know, if Theosophy under no uncertain terms teaches, we have the teaching of the perfectibility of man. Human beings can perfect themselves, and there are human beings among us who are perfected in every way. Psychologically, they, because of their own effort, they weren't born that way and given gifts by God, but through incarnations have done the work. And so psychologically, emotionally, intellectually, physically, have achieved a level of perfection that is the highest possible in this period of evolution. This is the statement. Now, we could tell that to a couple friends who are not students of theosophy, and sometimes they'll say, oh, come on, really? How do you say? Well, wait a minute. Let's look at some people would consider fairy tales. How many religions in the world look to leaders, saints, great philosophers, Buddha, Krishna, Christ? It's all there. So the point here is it's not there uniquely for Christianity that only Jesus is the one. Theosophy tells us, universally speaking, if it can be done by a human being, it can be done by all human beings and has been. It's just a matter of, are we open to the ideas? And if we are, we can be open, actually, to those, what we would refer to as Mahatmas or masters, to be open to them, not to personally engage, we don't even need to get into that right now, but teaching or studying and applying the philosophy as is given out by them puts us in rapport with them. And so in inner ways, there is a connection that is made that helps us more clearly see what's going. There's a hand back here.
We're also thinking about the Aesop fables. Oh. That deals with ethics and morals that are universal, that can be understood in any language.
Thank you. Yes, so there's Aesop's fables and, of course, the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is all stories and fairy tales, yet the philosopher can look into them if you've made the effort and see so much more in them. There's a hand over here.
So you mentioned that theosophy was a system of universal thought, which makes a lot of sense to me. But then, like, what is thought? I think that from where my perspective, I've always associated thought with language, but that seems to be so limiting. You know, so from a theosophical standpoint, what is thought? Thought outside of language seems to be more pure. Maybe that's what theosophy is all about. And we limit it by kind of confining it to these little symbols that we call language. And then the next step from there is that, like, maybe that's where wisdom comes in. Wisdom has nothing to do with language or ideas or knowledge. It's maybe thought outside of language.
HBB said to one of her students once, you know, you numbskull, whoever said that pure truth can ever be communicated to another using words. So, what is thought? Well, certainly either maybe we could, of course, if we're mind beings and mind is the power to think, then it seems that thought is the child of the mind. And of course, non-thinking beings cannot speak. That's not to say that animals don't communicate with each other, but speech specifically is unattainable by any mindless being. So our challenge, of course, is how clearly are we able to express our thoughts, how clearly are we able to express these thoughts with the English language that we have? Well, we have to do the best with what we have. The benefit of these original teachings being given out from day one in the English language it wasn't a mistake. It is the most widespread language in the world as of 1875 when the teachings were given out. And okay, so it's kind of commercially based. You know, perhaps the best language in the history of this period of evolution would have been Sanskrit, because that is, we understand, the most spiritually and mathematically and scientifically specific language, but nobody speaks it. So we have to do the best with what we can. And then, of course, there's the, when we read Theosophy, if we make the effort to put ourselves, you know, get that alpha wave going, start reading between the lines, and a lot more can come the third and fourth and fifth time that we read certain things that we're attracted to.
Thought is a vibration. And when someone speaks to us, the vibrations are turned into ideas. So many of the ancient wisdom, or much of the ancient wisdom, is found on glyphs and monoliths throughout the world. That they were standing stones. They were ever a reminder of our past and our future. So these weren't spoken. In fact, we are told that many of the events of the past should not be spoken because that gives them life again. So many of the events that happen in our evolution are not spoken. They are found by symbols and glyphs in places that you would not imagine, in churches, on the doorways of government buildings, but they're everywhere. And with much thanks to the Masons, but even to the Catholic Church, who has preserved many of the symbols that were used in ancient times but have been sort of used to promote a single idea. You know, the idea are what are important. You know, the thought comes first and the speech comes next. So it is a vibration. And we can see those and we create the vibration in ourself to understand it. So.
Yes?
You were talking about the value of theosophy in terms of helping to, you know, promote aspiration and inspiration to one who's learning. And I was also thinking about the notion that practical theosophy is the art of living, learning the art of living. What role would you say theosophy gives to faith in terms of this practicing the art of living? The reason I'm asking that is I'm thinking that we're always working with relative truth, and we know we have this emotional nature as well, where we're working, we need inspiration and aspirations. Could you speak to faith?
Sure.
We'll do just one thing.
Good.
Just one thing. A book that one must read is the Bhagavad Gita. It points out the path and how to obtain the goal. The idea of faith is talked about in that small book. And all beings are imbued with faith. It is something that is within us. And our goal is to find or place our faith in that which is eternal and boundless, immutable, and omnipresent. So our goal then would be to find out, where does that lie within me? And then as one is at the font or the fountainhead of that.
Sure. See, faith is kind of an interesting word. It can mean different things to different people. And so when the student of theosophy considers the word faith, we've got to keep it in line with we'll say, rational thought, right thinking, understanding of how the law works. So if one were to, you know, hold in view a particular something that's important, some kind of, you know, we'll just use the word goal, the faith that this is going to happen, because one has to remain fixed and focused on this, the faith that someone has that it's going to happen rests in what am I doing today and not doing to ensure that this goal is attained. It's not faith as in, well, I'll pray for it and hope that God does it for me. There's a lot of folks who really believe that their relatives in heaven are going to arrange things. that's fine, but that's not theosophy. Faith is faith in the law, and it really plays out if and only if we mindfully, thoughtfully, willfully make whatever the object of our faith come to fruition. If it's just a harebrained idea and we're not focused on it, it won't. So faith plays a big part in everybody's life. Yes?
150 years ago, as today, there must have been many, many religions in the world, and I'm sure a thousand different philosophies. Why do we need, why did HPB think that theosophy would be important when all of those already existed?
Well, you're right. So 150 years ago, what was going on in the 1870s? Why was theosophy needed? Well, let's look at what was going on in particular in the Western world. Slavery finally had just come to an end. It was, you know, we were in the aftermath of the Dark Ages still. You know, the idea, for instance, we talk about universal brotherhood. The idea in 1875 of your average Joe on the street thinking that he's connected to somebody in Hong Kong is ridiculous as far as he's concerned. Today, children of in Hong Kong can learn together with children in New York over a computer network. And theosophy brought the idea of universal brotherhood. The seeds that theosophy started sowing, that we are not, you know, separate from everybody else, that is what was introduced that was so important to the materialism of the 19th century. In fact, by 1893, theosophy had great influence in bringing together what was called the Parliament of World Religions. That was the first time in the history of planet Earth where you had bishops and Brahmins and lamas and yogis, everybody together in one convention with thousands of people in Chicago. And there was a lot of theosophical things going on. In fact, 100 years later in 1893, we did it again in New York. So the idea of universal brotherhood. And at the same time, think about it. This, I mean, we're talking the height of the Industrial Revolution. Who cares what we're doing to planet Earth? Well, how about if you view planet Earth as part of everything. This is one grand whole. So the seeds were sown. So not only now are we recognizing the reality of our children and the children of Hong Kong are getting to know each other like cousins, but our understanding of what's going on in the earth and the efforts of the environmentalists spring from a time in the 1800s when it wasn't even considered. Yet look at China today. There are towns in China. There's a special new Chinese phrase to refer to these towns. They're, and translated, it means it's a cancer town. Because the river or the streams or the current of the air that flows through that town, those people are gone. It's a cancer town. They haven't learned yet. Hopefully they'll take our example. We'll find out if they do. But we've moved from there. Yeah.
Amazing.
I'm sorry.
But also in the late 1800s, there was something else going on. Spiritualism. They were, you know, if you read the accounts of Abraham Lincoln, there are stories of how they were having seances and they were having channeling and talking to dead soldiers. And in fact, Lincoln was told several times that he was going to die. And that, and it was a hodgepodge of understanding. It was very materialistic. And one of the reasons HPB elucidated this philosophy was for that, because she scientifically proved what was going on, and much of it were hoaxes. And that in, I think it was 1200 BC, Ammonius Saccas, a philosopher in Alexandria, one of the greatest. They called him Theodidactus.
It's like 280.
200?
Yeah, AD. Yeah.
AD. Yeah, AD. And Theodidactus, or the God taught. And his movement was to bring all the religions of the world together into one homogeneous whole and work for the betterment of humanity. Well, you see where that idea went, but it's still alive. And HPB, Mr. Judge, rekindled that fire. And we are all very much aware that that fire is burning. But unfortunately, the materialism of the age is very dark and foreboding.
Yes.
With the responses given, it's not that the conditions were horrible and this group of people with great knowledge and wisdom decided at that time that something had to be done. In the dedication page of the Secret Doctrine, HP says that these teachings were put forth for theosophists all over the world, to paraphrase, because they asked for it. What does that mean? It means that in spite of the conditions of humanity at that time, there were a sizable number of human beings who did sense that something was wrong themselves and wanted to do something to change and needed the knowledge to do it. And that prompted the giving of the teachings. We can see that today. How many people, in spite of the chaos and problems in the world, are committed to serve and to help. And this kind of knowledge, this unifying knowledge for them today, is as important as it was in 1875.
Thank you. Yes?
I was thinking, too, the lost chord of Christianity was reincarnation teaching. And since the time of HPB, it's much more widely remembered, and even just, the common person on the street has, encountered the notion of reincarnation in this country in a way that they certainly were not encountering it, several hundred years ago, just because of the strong influence of Christianity in this country.
Thank you for the contribution here. So it was stated that, with HPB came this idea, this Eastern idea to the West of reincarnation, and along with it, karma. I mean, even karma, that's an Eastern word, and we understand that we're using that word because really there was nothing in the English language that could accurately describe the ideas, so we just brought that over from the Hindu. And so, yeah, today 26% of practicing Catholics believe in reincarnation, interestingly.
And also the fact that the fact that the world has become aware of other religions, and Buddhism has always taught the idea of reincarnation. And the fact that reincarnation is really spoken of in the Bible in several places, and that the hope that reincarnation brings is lost when it is hidden from view. So it is the hope of Christianity.
In the back?
And another reason theosophy was brought to the world, well, there's many reasons, but the materialism of the world was becoming rampant, not only in industry, but in religion and science. So, everything was becoming so materialized that really there wasn't any, spirituality was really on the wing in every facet of life. So we needed this countervailing force, which is the light of Asia. It was finally brought to the West.
And in the century since the theosophy was introduced, look at what has happened to societies. Governments have changed. Western Europe has literally gone from kings and queens to democratic, socially elected countries. The banking system is way under flux, you know, and has been for years now. So many changes in society. It's just interesting the force like that there was.
But another example of the materialism is the idea that you put forth of children in Japan speaking to children in Washington or in New York. The fax machine. You know, all these devices that we have invented are from our unconscious nature, our spiritual nature. That these are things that all humans are capable of. But because we're in such a materialistic time, we see them manifesting outside of us. And we're amazed. We're absolutely amazed. But this is what the materialism has done.
There was a hand, yes.
And the other event that took place when HPV came to give these teachings is that science itself was very material and like a closed system. Many scientists felt within 10 or 20 years at that time they would have almost everything worked out. That was before Einstein and before quantum physics. And basically what's happened in science is all of a sudden consciousness has now intervened and is a part of theoretical physics today, where there was no science. Consciousness itself was not part of a closed system of physics. So... that was another dimension of the Theosophical Revolution.
Thank you for the contribution here. We're talking about how materialistic science was at the time. The teaching, the presumption was that the building block of matter was the atom, and HPB taught that's ridiculous. The fact that the atom is infinitely divisible is the basis for occultism. And this was, now she passed in the early 1890s, within 10 years or so, the discovery of the electron was made, and that was it. And the X-rays and all of this, that was step forward. There's been a hand here.
Yeah. Well, it appears that much of what we heard is rather complicated, and we've understood that to begin to understand, you have to simplify. And she stated that there are three fundamental ideas which we should familiarize ourselves with and apply it as we proceed to understand what was given out. What are those basic fundamental ideas?
What were the fundamental... Well, to best understand the philosophy, to more clearly and deeply understand the philosophy, if we keep these three ideas going in the back of our heads, we're going to be able to get deeper and deeper and broader in the philosophy. And they simply are, understand the idea of deity that is omnipresent and boundless, but is not, you know, not the personal God. That is one of the greatest problems with the Western world, is praying to a personal God outside of ourselves. So deity is infinite and omnipresent. It is the source of all power. The second, of course, is everything occurs according to cycles, the law of cycles, which includes cycles of karma in human nature and nature around us as well, and reincarnation, because without reincarnation, karma couldn't play out. We're reincarnated because of our karma, and depending on what we do and how we live our lives, it'll set the direction for future lives until we are perfected and will not have to go through this, so to speak. And then the third fundamental really is, as it applies to here, it's evolution, the evolution of all of life, the evolution of intelligence through the forms, which proceeds impersonally according to universal impulse for the lower kingdoms. But the key here is once the intelligence is in the human form, hello, we are responsible for our individual evolution as soul. It's not the universal impulse. It's the choices we make, the decisions we make, and the things that we do. We are personally responsible. And so the process of evolution simply is, the goal of it is that each and all will have complete wisdom and knowledge of all that is and recognize the unity of all in all.
The prior statement about consciousness and science is that science is at the forefront of many great discoveries. Quantum theory, but field theory. You know, the fact that the astral body, that electromagnetic aspect of our very being, has been discovered, but they don't know what it is. And from this understanding, one will find, or science will find, the missing link. And that the only pure science that exists today is mathematics. It is the science that was taught in Egypt. There are many other sciences which we have lost, but mathematics is the purest that we now have with us. But as Plato said, that the world geometrizes, that everything is mathematical, and that everything can be put in those kind of symbols. So when we think we know something, something else always pops up.
Yes?
If mathematics is the only pure science, what is it that makes our sciences impure?
Well, mostly from the wrong premise. If the premise is incorrect, the conclusion will be incorrect. And that the problem with our science is that they aren't based on fundamental truths. They're based on truths that have not been proven. They are speculated upon that they exist. But if one was firmly founded in fundamental ideas, as just were elucidated, of what is God, what is the periodic expression of the universe and cycles, and the purpose of even being here. There is not a grasp of the eternal. You have to go from particular to universal, but you have to know what that universal is. You can't just, universal. You pick a random idea and say that's universal. That's not universal. There are fundamental ideas that have been repeated and repeated and repeated for mankind to grab hold of and to guide their life and to make this world a better place.
Actually, thinking outside of the box, mathematics is not a pure science. 1 + 1 = 2, but not knowing that 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 3 - 2 = 2. Now, a pure science is a formulation of matter itself. Gold is gold, no matter what it is. Silver is silver, no matter what it is. The fundamental elements are a pure science, but say if we met an alien, so to speak, we don't know that the way that they think would be 1 + 1 = 2. It could be 1 + 3 = 4 - 2 = 2. So trying to communicate on a simple basis of mathematics wouldn't exactly be correct. But if you based it on the fundamental elements of existence, that's the only, in my opinion, pure science.
Well, when the statement is made by Pythagoras that mathematics is the only exact science, we think what he's talking about, for instance, in calculus, if you set all the differentials to 0, you're getting the exact, you know, and this 1 + 4 - 3 = 2. Anyway, the two are equal on both sides of the equal sign, therefore it's exact. But when we say mathematics, we're not talking about arithmetic, mathematics, philosophically, arithmetic is one small part of it. It's the science of magnitudes, of this, the study of the relationship between forms, figure, and forces, the study of quantities as expressed symbolically, certainly, but just the idea of the science of magnitudes, geometrically speaking, you know, at, you know, the Hermetic phrase, as above, so below. What it's saying is there is a similarity between the two. It doesn't mean that they're both identical on the one hand, but really it does, because it means they're identical in principle. So we need to look at the principle of the things that we're talking about.
But and in the case of geometry, you know, you have a line, one and one, that's two, and a triangle, and a square. I mean, there's all, you can associate numbers with geometric figures. So we're not saying that you're, you know, it's a conversation that we could have all day. Well, we'd like to remind you that all the activities at this lodge are sustained through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And all are welcome to participate. Our class for next Sunday is The Three Objectives. And we hope to see you next week. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.